Innovation Alberta, a program about science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. On this evening's program, fairy rings. They're the bane of anyone who likes a nice green lawn out front. Now, a little bacteria from Sedgwick may be the final answer in cures for fairy rings. And eating disorders. They're on the rise among adolescents. Two researchers at the Grey Nuns Hospital in Edmonton are developing a unique study to take into the classroom. And the little software program that could, WinTax, out of the garage and into the international marketplace with Intuit Canada, the software company headquartered in Edmonton. All this coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. Trying to cure fairy rings is the stuff of old wives' tales. Boiling water, bleach, digging. The list goes on and on. Yet nothing seems to work for very long. Until now, that is. There's a little bacterium lurking in the soil that Prem Karbanda is testing. And the site this senior scientist from the Alberta Research Council has chosen for his experiments couldn't be more perfect, if not unusual. It's a strip of fairy ring-infested boulevard along 91st Street at 36th Avenue in Edmonton.
It's very difficult to create fairy rings artificially, and this is a natural setting, and the fairy rings are quite severe in this area, and it gives us a natural spot to test our bacterium.
Why are fairy rings such a problem?
First of all, because the fairy rings kill grass, and it doesn't look very good to the homeowners, and there are ugly spots in the lawns. Besides that, if people can live with the fairy rings, then there's not a problem. Once the grass is dead, other unwanted grasses like quack grass and other weeds can take over, and that is a problem for the homeowners.
Fairy rings have stymied people for such a long time. Nobody can seem to come up with something that gets rid of them. And yet this is something that you're working on. What exactly is it that you're experimenting with?
Well, at the Alberta Research Council, we always try very innovative and environmentally friendly methods to control diseases and other pests. Here we are using a bacterium that we found locally in local soils here, and we are trying to use this particular bacterium to kill the fairy ring fungus.
Where did you find this? How do you find something locally?
Well, while I was working with the canola diseases, like a black leg of canola, and a few samples came from Sedgwick, and we found this particular bacterium inhibiting the black leg fungus in our petri plates. So we tried this particular fungus against many other fungi, and we found it was inhibiting many more fungi than just the blackleg fungus. And that's how we found this particular bacterium.
Well, what made you think that you would try it against fungus or even fairy ring?
Well, one of the commercial growers of edible mushrooms, they approached us that they had a problem with their mushroom growing because a lot of other fungi were killing their mushrooms. And they approached us that whether we could try our bacterium, which is environmentally friendly, to control the diseases in mushrooms. So we tried our bacterium in that setting, and killing those fungi, our bacterium also killed the mushrooms. And from that one, we got the idea, maybe if this particular bacterium is killing the edible mushrooms, it should kill the unwanted mushrooms in the fairy ring situation.
You're trying it out now on fairy rings here in the city of Edmonton. How exactly are you using it?
Well, we are using this particular bacterium in several different ways. First of all, we are using it along with the compost. The compost works as a carrier for this particular bacterium and also provides some food material for this bacterium. So this is one treatment that we are using along with the in compost. Second treatment that we are using is in a surfactant solution. We are putting it this particular bacterium in spore forms in the surfactant solution and is applying to the fairy rings. That's one of the things we are trying to research on, that how many times it will be necessary to apply during the season that would kill this particular or a fungus and relieve the problem. We will be applying in this particular experiment once a month, and perhaps a total of 4 applications will be made this year.
Now, you've cut a sample out of the soil. Can you show me what this is? What are these white things down here?
Well, this is the fungus that causes fairy rings. The fungus starts in the thatch layer as in one circular spot, and slowly it starts increasing outward. It increases down to up to 30 centimeter in many cases, and it forms a network of mycelium, or the fungus itself, and it is such a dense fungus that makes it impossible for the water to go down to the roots of these grasses, and makes it a very hydrophobic layer by which the water cannot percolate any further, and because of lack of water, the grass dies.
How do you know that this is actually going to work?
First of all, our bacterium is effective against this particular fungus. In a petri plate, it inhibits the fungus, which is called Marasmius, and it does inhibit the growth of the fungus under laboratory conditions. But another important thing is that we know that this particular bacterium is effective against several other fungi, and so it has the upper hand in a way that because it has a wide spectrum, it controls several fungi, it may not only control this particular fairy rings, but also many other diseases also, and perhaps it will give the sod or the grass a chance to survive in the absence of other fungi as well.
What's the mechanism? How does it actually work in order to fight the fairy ring?
Well, one method that we think it works is because it releases a metabolite which inhibits the many fungi. Actually, we have isolated the metabolite, and that metabolite has been characterized now. And that metabolite is quite toxic to many fungi. And when the bacterium multiplies, in that multiplication process, it does release that particular metabolite, which kills many fungi.
When do you think we might see this on the market?
Well, it will take at least 2 or 3 years before we can confirm our results here. And after that, maybe take another couple of years before it can pass through the federal government registration as a pesticide. So we will, if we want to use it as a pesticide, perhaps we can call it as a growth promoter and get to the market earlier.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Prem Karbunda, a senior scientist with the Alberta Research Council. Coming up, some new research on eating disorders among adolescents. It's not easy growing up, and one of the alarming manifestations of the troubles that hit adolescents is the growing incidence of eating disorders. Having already developed a test that teachers can use to screen for children at risk, 2 Edmonton researchers are now leading the way to develop a model that will test the effectiveness of preventive programs. Diane Drummond is the Eating Disorder Promotion and Prevention Specialist with the Alberta Mental Health Board, and Susan Hare is a clinical dietitian at the Grey Nuns Hospital. I asked Suzanne about their first project, the screening test.
The eating disorder screen that we developed is called READY, which is Risk of Eating Disorder Inventory. and what it is a 50-question questionnaire that students fill out, and it determines their risk of developing an eating disorder, plus whether or not they already have eating disorder behavior. And it was done by actually going out and surveying students in Alberta, and we did both Edmonton and rural Alberta, and they completed the screens for us, and then we threw out the questions that didn't work and that kind of thing. And about 500 students participated, so it was quite a good cross-section of people within this area.
What are some of the things that would actually be risk factors?
The risk factors that we pick up within our screen are body image problems, maladaptive thoughts, and maladaptive thoughts would be things like If I was thinner, I would be happier. Depression, okay. Self-esteem, dieting behavior. So those are the main ones that we pick up.
Following on the success of the screening test, Suzanne and her partner put together a manual and CD about eating disorders. It's called Liking the Me I See in the Mirror.
That came out of our screen and the school's demand for some kind of intervention to happen. So what we've done is we've taken what we've been presenting in the schools and put it together in a manual for teachers and other health professionals to try and teach body image in a way that we know is as safe and effective as possible. So our topics include things like building self-esteem, looking at our outer self and our inner self, and perfectionism versus excellence and trying to go towards the excellence model and that kind of thing. We also developed a manual or workbook for parents so that when the kids go home, it's reinforced by parents, the same messages. And parents can work on their own with this manual as well. And it's actually selling quite well, much more than the professional one. We're kind of surprised about that. What we are hoping to do is take the ideas from these workbooks and manuals and put them together and develop a model for the education program within the schools. All of our stuff is based on Alberta learning curriculum, and it is changing. The health curriculum is changing, so we'll be updating as we go through that.
The researchers are now embarking on a study to test the effectiveness of prevention programs. The Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research has awarded Suzanne and her colleague Diane Drummond a grant to develop a wellness model that they will again take into the schools.
What we're looking at doing is establishing 8 one-hour education sessions for students and evaluating before the students, before we start educating the students with this model, immediately after and 6 months after, to see if any positive effects or might be sustained over that period of time.
You're focusing on wellness. Why is that?
There's been a lot of literature coming out lately that suggests that using the illness model or talking specifically about the illness, and another way of saying that is talking specifically about eating disorder behaviors to children and to adolescents may actually cause more harm than good. And that it isn't hard to understand that, because that's really kind of a copycat effect. Students may get more ideas than actually preventing it. We do know that talking about eating disorders with students raises awareness, but there may be that and the other negative side of it that we haven't been really very aware of until just recently.
So by focusing on wellness rather than disease or the disorders, what exactly will you be trying to do?
We'll be trying to help students to be better able to deal with the pressures and the messages that they get on a day-to-day basis about having to look a certain way, be a certain way, helping them to feel more confident to deal with those pressures, helping them to have an improved self-esteem. We'll be promoting the not dieting message, because really getting into dieting, especially for children, is a very unhealthy thing to do unless it's medically supervised. So by and large, it's education to help keep kids healthy or well, rather than looking at the illness itself.
So in a sense, it's like boosting the immune system. Is that the case?
That's a really good analogy. That's a very good analogy. We have a large population of very vulnerable young people right now for a large number of reasons. But they're vulnerable, and I really believe that we put way too much emphasis on physical appearance these days, maybe because we're in such a fast-paced society that's all we've got time for, or often we feel that's all we've got time for. We don't take the time to get to know people well. We make a lot of judgments based on what they look like, and that has lots of negative implications. And so I think that helping kids to get beyond that, to build their strengths, to realize that what's inside is so much more important than what they may look like. If we can help children and adolescents to do that, then I think we'd have a much healthier population of young people. But it's a message that adults need to endorse as well.
How serious is this problem?
We know that eating disorders themselves, eating disorders are the extreme manifestation of a poor body image. But we know that eating disorders are on the rise. We know the literature is telling us that in the adult population, it's not increasing nearly as much as it is with the adolescent population. So we do know that it is an increasing problem. We certainly hear more about it now, but that simply could be because we're talking more about it. But bottom line, there are more eating disorders out there than there have ever been before, especially in our Western society.
The researchers will begin by developing a model which is aimed at children in grades 5 and 7. According to Suzanne Hare, a number of people are already doing body image work, but this research project is stepping into new territory.
However, there's very little in terms of actual studying those programs. And so that's what we're doing, is we're actually going to do a scientific study on the program to make sure that it's actually working, so that when we put dollars towards a program like this, we know that it's effective and safe and so on.
How will you do that?
What we're going to do is we're going to do our pilot, so we'll really work out the kinks, and then we're going to have two groups. We're going to have one that receive the intervention and one that don't. Now, having said that they don't receive the intervention, what I mean is they don't receive the intervention during the study program. If the program proves to be effective, they will receive it afterwards, so everybody will receive benefit. But we'll compare the groups that do receive the intervention with the groups that don't, and we'll get an idea of how effective it is.
That was Suzanne Hare, a clinical dietitian at the Grey Nuns Hospital in Edmonton. I also spoke with Diane Drummond, an eating disorder promotion and prevention specialist with the Alberta Mental Health Board. Coming up, the little computer tax program that shook the world. If you've browsed through the rows of software in any computer store, you're bound to have seen products called Quicken or QuickBooks. At tax time, it's boxes of QuickTax that spill out everywhere. Now sold by a company headquartered in Edmonton called Intuit Canada, QuickTax started off under a different name, WinTax. It was an innovative accounting program for what was then the new Windows-based computer system. WinTax was the brainchild of two graduates from the University of Alberta, Bruce Johnson, a computer programmer, and Chad Frederick, an accountant. Now the director of strategic planning for Intuit Canada, Chad told me about launching their product on a shoestring.
We shrink-wrapped the product in a spare office within my accounting practice. And that's right, we had at that time dug up every computer with a floppy drive that we could find, because we were using them to duplicate the disks. And yes, my kids were flipping disks in and out of computers and shrink-wrapping packages. And that got us through, definitely through the first year, where we were, of course, trying to keep everything on bare-bones budget. Marketing was no small challenge, and in fact that led to a number of things. We had approached in the early stages of development, we had approached retailers, and they said, "Oh, you know, that sounds like a wonderful idea." So we definitely got a good response from retailers, but the reality was that when we set out on foot with our product in hand, that the loyalty that they had to the competitors that were entrenched in the marketplace for some time, 10 and 15 years, ended up sort of taking the priority on the shelf rather than the newcomer. So that was definitely a challenge, getting the product to market. And in fact, that set us on a course the following year to look for a partner who would not only have deeper pockets than we had, and also some idea about what it took to be successful in the marketplace.
Who did you find, and why were they interested in you?
We approached both a company in Canada and one in the U.S. We ended up striking a deal with the company out of the U.S., and our attraction to them at the time was that they held about a very significant share of the tax market in the U.S., both in terms of consumer tax products and professional tax products. And we saw their success as something we wanted to see our product in Canada enjoy. And what they saw in us was an opportunity to get into the Canadian marketplace, which is something they had been contemplating for a few years, but we're not aware of any particular products or companies that would make that transition work for them. So it was a sort of a marriage that both sides saw synergies going forward, and that's how we got our start with actually a company called Chipsoft in the U.S. that merged with Intuit a few months later. So we overnight or very shortly became part of the Intuit group of companies.
So both you and the company out of the United States saw that there would be benefits to working together. And how did you take that then and develop what you have now here in Edmonton in moving essentially from your office in your other practice to a huge building where you have over 300 employees?
A good part of what our development history has looked like has definitely been developing the WinTax product, which is now called QuickTax, and seeing it mature, both in terms of its functions and features, and also in terms of meeting and in fact beating our competitors in the marketplace and doing very well, and that's caused our organization to grow in and of itself. But as well, Intuit had two other primary products that we have taken into Canada and localized for the Canadian market, Quicken and QuickBooks, and those have done very well for us in Canada as well. We enjoy a large share of the market in Canada with personal finance software with Quicken, and also our QuickBooks product has done very well in becoming a number one player in Canada for small businesses to do their finance and accounting. So those are the primary products that we have built on for and localized for the Canadian market. As you've mentioned, we've also done work through Canada for other international subsidiaries of Intuit, primarily the UK. We've done some development for other countries as well, Germany and Australia. And one of the things that has helped us share the sensitivities of those countries is, in fact, the struggles that we had getting into the Quebec marketplace in Canada.
Well, just talking about sensitivities, while I was waiting down in the main lobby, I was reading your mission statement, and one of the things that really caught my eye was dealing with employee expectations and how you shall balance the work with personal life and assign reasonable workloads. And to me, that just seemed right out of step with the way the rest of the corporate world, the way it's going. Tell me a little bit about your philosophy and how you've developed that here at Intuit Canada.
The reasonable workloads, I guess, is a relative term. I think that we're not shy of having pretty huge expectations of our staff and of our people. With that, though, we also, I think, provide a fairly flexible environment. The last thing you'd ever see in one of our facilities is a time clock. People really do come and go as they please, and it's not uncommon to see people here very late into the evening. So workload tends to drive the work level and the expectations that we have for our staff. And through that, we try and provide as much freedom and flexibility in their schedule and what they think is important as we can.
Now, you've decided to stay in Edmonton rather than going down to Silicon Valley in California. How is it that you manage then to have a very successful software business here in northern Alberta?
Mm-hmm. So I guess there's two sides to that question. One is how do you attract people to a Silicon Valley type of company when you're not in the Bay Area? I guess we like to look at the other side of that equation, and that is that we have a lot of very strong people here, and they're here because they want to be in Edmonton, or they like the family life or the culture of Edmonton as opposed to the Bay Area. So they choose to be here. And so the advantage that that gives us, one of the particular advantages it gives us, is that the people that we have here are very strong, and they're not interested in moving on to Company X tomorrow. The reality is they like Edmonton, and they like the business that we're in here. So providing a little bit of Silicon Valley in Edmonton has that advantage that I suppose you could say there isn't a lot of competition to us in this area. But again, the other side of that is that we do have some good people, and they're here because they want to work in Edmonton.
Of course, one of the other things is that the company has to survive. And when you look at what's happening with high tech elsewhere in the world, you look at the NASDAQ and it goes down, and you look at like Nortel and it's practically off the map and different things. What is it? What does it take in order to survive in this industry?
Well, there's no question we're seeing a fallout of a lot of dot-coms, and I guess that news is somewhat getting old now. Intuit as a company, of course, has a number of web products and offerings, but as well has a stable of core products and services that have done the company very well over the last number of years in terms of revenue and profits. And so from that perspective, Intuit, both in the U.S. and in Canada, is a bit of a hybrid. In the one sense, we've played with the dot-coms in developing internet properties, but on the other hand, we have a base and a support for our company of revenues and profits through other offerings that have matured, both in terms of their functions and features that we offer to consumers, but also in terms of the marketplace. They've matured and have earned their rightful place on the shelf.
Where do you see things heading now?
In terms of our business, where do we see the future? I think that for many years, technology has really been ahead of consumers' ability to utilize the technology, both in terms of hardware and software. And I believe that the future continues to lie in taking complex tasks and making them easy for consumers. A small example might be where, maybe I'd like to track my personal finances, but I really don't have the time or the patience or the know-how to fire up Quicken and enter all my information. But if I could, use a website and go to my bank or my credit card and automatically have all of my information, what I've spent, where I've spent it on, have it assimilated into a product like Quicken, where then I could sort of slice and dice that information and tell me how much I spent on whatever over the past number of months. We think that's where the future lies, is definitely making complex tasks easier for consumers.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Cheryl.
That was Chad Frederick, co-inventor of WinTax, now sold as QuickTax, and he's the director of strategic planning at Intuit Canada, which is based in Edmonton. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. Visit our website at innovationalberta.ckua.com. You can download past programs or listen to them on Real Audio. Technical producer for Innovation Alberta is Scott Franchuk. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Good night.